From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump's transition team held a conference call with reporters this morning and announced there will not be any new cabinet-level appointments until at least Monday. We also learned today that Trump continues to speak with a number of world leaders. Meanwhile, France is in the early stages of what's likely to be a new administration. On Sunday, Republican voters will choose their candidate for next year's presidential election. And whoever wins stands a good chance of leading the country because the approval rating of the socialist French president François Hollande is at a dismally low 4%. But any Republican candidate will have to beat out the rising far-right populist Marine Le Pen. The BBC's Hugh Schofield joins us now from Paris. And Hugh, let's start with the election this weekend. Who are the candidates?
Well, yeah, there's Alain Juppé, who some of you might remember from way back in the 90s when he was prime minister. Before that, foreign minister, famously in the Balkan Wars and so on, so a bit of a veteran. And then François Fillon, a younger man, 62, who was prime minister under Nicolas Sarkozy. They're different, but I think viewed from outside, you'd have to say, well, actually, there's a lot of similarities between their two programs, because there is broad agreement on the centre-right in France that there needs to be a kind of liberal, economic liberal, free market, if not revolution, certainly big change. And so both of those candidates are calling for big cuts in state spending, changes in working hours. But I have to insist, you know, when you look at the programs without knowing much about French politics, you might say, well, actually, they've got an awful lot in common.
Yeah, these proposals that you mentioned, let's dig into them just a little bit more, because they have called for ending the 35-hour work week in France, as you say, cutting taxes, raising the retirement age to 65, putting a quota on immigrants. This is interesting because it's moving to the right at the same time as voters appear to be rejecting the presidency of the socialist president, François Hollande.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there is a rejection of the left. There is abroad in the land a sense that politics, as it's been conducted for the last 30, 40 years, has served France very badly. The conclusion they all come to is that the country needs to do what its neighbours has done, which is to loosen the grip of the state.
And boy, this speaks to Hollande's approval rating. The polls showing 4% approval. That is almost impossible to believe. Will Hollande even bother putting his hat in the ring to run again?
Well, we don't know. It's quite possible not. Certainly, you know, everyone is, well, I won't say everyone is hoping he won't, but I mean, an awful lot of people.
Almost everybody.
I mean, in the Socialist Party are hoping that he won't, because if Hollande runs, there's a feeling that the performance will be so abysmally low in the first round, where there are many candidates. Not only will they not get through to the second round, which probably won't happen under any candidate, but the party could be beaten by far left wingers, by the independent Emmanuel Macron, and really be humbled. So there's a lot of pressure on him not to run.
Well, look, the winner of this weekend's Republican election will still have to beat the far-right leader Marine Le Pen. She's a populist and anti-immigrant candidate. These, of course, are issues that have resonated very much recently with voters both in the UK and in the United States. How is it looking for Le Pen?
Good in the sense that, I mean, nothing's happened to sort of shake her faith in herself. the polls stay pretty strong. What's happened in Britain and America has given, is grist to her mill. She can say, look, around the world, around the Western world, the wind is still in her sails up to a point. But, well, two things. One, the system counts against her, and it's very hard to see her winning.
What do you mean?
You can't rule it out. I mean, the system counts against her in the sense that this is a two-round election with multi-party candidate in the first round. Two go through. OK, let us accept that she goes through. It's quite likely that she will. By far the greatest probability, and certainly all the polls show that no matter what combination there is, her against whoever, there'll be, just a rallying against her. There will always be a majority against her.
Yes, but we've seen with these populist candidates around the country that the polls sometimes would surprise us.
Indeed. But, I mean, given that she's most likely to run against a right-wing candidate, probably, François Fillon or Alain Juppé, whoever wins this weekend, there is a sort of majority feeling against the National Front. I mean, 60, 70% that is, uniformly, says quite clear they reject the National Front. There is this a tradition in France of what they call the Republican vote, where you turn out to keep the National Front out. And I've no real reason to see why that won't happen again. I mean, and I know the arguments about how the polls have become totally unpredictable and all the rest of it. But I just have a strong feeling that it's just not going to happen in France. I think a strong right-wing candidate the odds are that François Fillon will win this. So I don't think it's even a given that Le Pen will get through to the second round. Though, of course, she is a major, major factor in French politics today and probably will get through. But even if she does get through to the second round, I personally don't see how she can possibly win.
Okay. The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And closer to home, North Carolinians still don't know who their governor will be next year. Incumbent Republican Pat McCrory is trailing by nearly 8,000 votes. His Democratic challenger, Roy Cooper, has claimed victory. But McCrory says there was enough voter fraud to sway the election, and he's called for a recount. Jeff Tabiri is with Here and Now contributor WUNC, and he's on the line from Chapel Hill. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Hello.
So the current vote margin, something like less than 1 percentage point, and McCrory is well within his rights to call for a recount.
He absolutely is at this point. It's about 7,700 votes. That's the latest tabulation from the State Board of Elections. One thing to note here is that on election night, Democrat Roy Cooper came in ahead of Republican incumbent Pat McCrory by about 5,000 votes. So since the 2.5 weeks since election night, his lead has actually grown, yes, to your point, very small numbers, but it's actually grown by about 50%, so up to 7,700 votes, as long as it remains within 10,000 votes, as all the provisional and absentee ballots are cast, the governor can request a recount, which he has formally done and which we will likely have in the coming weeks.
But he is getting heat for that decision. So we mentioned he says there's voter fraud going on. He cites cases of people who have cast absentee ballots but then died before the election. What kind of evidence does the governor have, and could there possibly be enough cases out there to sway the election in his favor? As you say, the lead's growing against him.
At this point, there is no evidence of widespread voting fraud in the state of North Carolina. His camp has filed protests or complaints in more than half of the 100 counties alleging that people who had died voted. They're alleging that people who were felons voted. They're alleging that people voted twice. But in terms of empirical evidence or concrete data, that's very slim at this point. And what has happened, whether it's real or perceived, is a scene of chaos has developed here. And there are some fundamental questions about the integrity of the election. But at this point, there is no evidence that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or really even hundreds of votes should be thrown out. Now, they're alleging that. But at this point, the number of votes that are even in question, if all of them were to, you know, move toward the McCrory pile, it still wouldn't be enough to sway the results of this outcome.
Now, it's important to go back in history a little bit here, because Republicans in North Carolina have been talking about voter fraud for a while now. In 2013, McCrory signed into law a measure that was later struck down by the Supreme Courts because it was thought to suppress the black vote. What is the relationship between the voting law that Republicans have been pushing in North Carolina and what we're seeing today?
Voting law is certainly a contentious and long-standing divisive political tool here in North Carolina. And it's more than just, of course, a political tool. But that law that you mentioned from 2013 mandated photo ID, reduced early voting, and did away with same-day registration. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond ruled that it was unconstitutional, said essentially that Republican lawmakers in North Carolina had acted with racial bias in putting this piece of policy forward, and it was undone pretty quickly. I think it's only natural to wonder what has happened in the last couple of weeks with this perceived fraud. Again, whether it's legitimized and whether more evidence comes forward or not. But one has to wonder what Republican lawmakers will do, if anything, when they come back for the long session in January in terms of using this as a foundation or groundwork and perhaps taking another crack at voter ID or again changing election law here in the state.
Well, some big questions also swirling around North Carolina, wondering if the state legislature will just step in themselves and name McCrory the winner. And it looks like state law allows that.
It is it's a little more complicated. This has only happened once. It happened in 2004, not in a governor's race, but in a council of state race for an education position. And with that instance, there were missing ballots. There were thousands of votes that had been contested. And at the end of the day there, the Democratic candidate who was up by a couple of thousand votes, the election in question went to the legislature. And at that time, a democratically held legislature did certify the victory for that candidate. Now, if that were to happen in this case, and the lawmakers and the experts believe at this point that this is still a long shot, we are expecting that there would be some kind of larger challenge, that for the incumbent Pamukkure, for him to say, oh, you know, these 70,000 votes or these 15,000 votes, he would have to question something that would be a little bit more broad and throw into question really the results and demonstrate that he should have won. And at this point, we haven't seen that kind of evidence.
Jeff, is North Carolina going to have a governor by January 7th, the day the inauguration is supposed to take place?
It's a good question. We certainly hope so. And in an interesting exchange I had with a longtime legislative staffer earlier today, he said there are conflicting provisions in the Constitution. One says that it would be the acting governor, Cooper, while another provision says the existing governor holds over until things are finalized. So all sorts of uncertainty here in North Carolina, Peter.
Wow. It'll be an interesting few weeks. Jeff Tiberi is the Capitol Bureau Chief with Here and Now contributor WUNC on the line from Chapel Hill. Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure.
This month, the world looked up in awe at the supermoon, and the Farmer's Almanac says December will bring a cold moon. That's when the winter cold fastens its grip and the nights become long and dark. Well, we took a long look at the dark night sky this summer. We were visiting Yellowstone National Park for the 100th anniversary of the Park Service, and one night I crossed the Fire Hole River with park rangers Tammy Corchero and Rebecca Rowland. Are we going to, like, step off this thing at any point accidentally?
No. we don't want to do that.
Okay.
There's railings all the way up.
Now, if the sun were shining, we'd have seen a kaleidoscope of blues and reds and yellows that ring the famous Excelsior Geyser and the Grand Prismatic Spring. But at night, from this vantage point, you couldn't really see anything. You could only hear.
That's the runoff from Excelsior Geyser, pouring out of a geyser crater into the Firehole River.
And the steam is lifting up off the ground and kind of blending in with the Milky Way.
Yes. So we're going to go up a little farther on the boardwalk because it's really cool to see the Milky Way from up top here.
And the Milky Way is why we came. The rangers led me through the rising steam to a spot on the boardwalk where at once the whole galaxy bursts into view. Turns out, you can see something in Yellowstone at night. Tammy Corchero is a park ranger whose specialty is stars.
The night sky out here is overwhelming. It's amazing. It's like we're completely surrounded here by the universe, wouldn't you say?
You can see the Milky Way maybe as clear as I have ever seen the Milky Way before.
Awesome. Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that because about a third of the population of the world can't see the Milky Way anymore. And that includes about 80% of the population of North America. So we now have whole generations of people here in the United States who have never seen the Milky Way. Huh. And so that's, you know, one reason why it's so important to protect dark skies like this. It makes me kind of sad to think that there are people that might go through their whole life and never experience something like this. You know, there actually was an astronomer who worked for the U.S. Naval Observatory. His name was Jeff Chester, and he said the night sky is the world's largest national park with its stark beauty available to anyone who steps outside and looks up.
I can see a satellite moving across the sky there. What else do you see?
Well, you know, sometimes when you sit under a dark sky like this, there's so many stars, and it is really exceptionally clear tonight. There's so many stars that you almost can't even recognize the constellations that you do know.
There's the Big Dipper.
We see the Big Dipper, okay? And the Big Dipper is not actually a constellation. It's
what?
No. It's an
astrology. You're blowing my mind here. What are you saying the Big Dipper is not
a constellation? It's not a constellation. It's actually an asterism. And an asterism is a highly recognizable part of a constellation.
Time out. Stop. What are you doing right now?
So this is a really cool tool that astronomers, and I'm not an astronomer, but I love to share the night sky with people. So I don't know how they did it before this.
You are lightsabering.
Isn't it cool?
Outer space.
I wish that Rebecca had one too.
I love this thing. What is this? What's it called?
It's a laser pointer, and these
No, but it's not a normal laser pointer.
It is.
Well, it's a pretty high-powered laser pointer.
Can I just run my finger through it?
Yeah, I think you'll be okay.
Whoa! Oh, my God. Oh, that was so weird.
Cool.
There's a giant green light just came off my fingernail. No,
I
never have.
We use them at Carlsbad Caverns.
I feel like a small child or something.
Yeah. These are awesome. So they help us to, you know, point out distinct things in the night sky. So the Big Dipper is a part of the constellation Ursa Major.
Oh, that's right. We were talking about the Big Dipper.
Right. Okay. So the Great Bear, and so the Dipper part of it, that's his body, and then the handle, that's his tail. One really cool thing about the Big Dipper is that it helps us to orient ourselves at night. So if you follow these front two stars here...
Can I see if I remember my middle school astronomy
class?
Yes,
definitely.
If you follow
awesome.
Those front two stars, yep. Is it going to point me to the North Star?
Yes, Polaris, that star right there.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that awesome?
And so you just found that star out of the middle of a sea of stars.
I've been out here a few times. So this star, Polaris, is a relatively stationary star, at least how it appears to us. And the reason why it's stationary is because it lies directly above the Earth's axis of rotation. So if you took a line and you drew it from the South Pole through the center of the Earth, through the North Pole, and extended it out into space, it would eventually intersect with Polaris.
Huh.
Now, an interesting thing about Polaris is that it hasn't always been and it will not always be the North Star, because there's enough wobble in the Earth's rotation on its axis that over time our view of the stars changes. So in about 2,000 years, this star right here, Arai, will become the North Star. So sometime around the year 4100. Okay, here's another cool star. Can you see that red star right there?
Let's see.
So I'm kind of pointing. I'll take the laser
pointer.
Yeah,
I mean, I can, but I would never have guessed that that was red unless you told me.
Right. You kind of have to know what you're looking at. That's called the Garnet Star, and it's part of this constellation Cepheus. That's believed to be one of the reddest stars in the sky, and it's also one of the biggest stars in the sky. That's actually a red supergiant star. I'll show you another one here in Scorpius that's, you know, looks more like a supergiant star. That star, let me find it again, right here, is almost 900 million miles in diameter.
And yet it looks like a tiny
little prick of light. It's a tiny dot. You would never find that star if I hadn't pointed it out to you.
I don't know how you did it.
Well, because I know where it is.
Are you lying to me?
No, I'm not making... Well, I could totally make stuff up out here, couldn't I?
Oh my gosh, did you just see that shooting star?
Yeah. No, I was looking over here this way.
So, where we're standing right now, and if the sun were up and it were the middle of the day, there would be hundreds, maybe thousands of people here in the middle of the summer, right?
Oh,
right.
Yes.
Now, we are absolutely by ourselves.
Awesome.
How does the park change for you when the sun goes down?
Well, it provides us, or it provides me, but all of us, access to this whole other half of Yellowstone. And because this park has recognized the value of dark night skies, we are working to protect it. The park does not allow any outdoor lighting outside of develop areas. So no lights on the roads, no lights on the trails, and that's to preserve the quality of this wilderness setting that we have here in Yellowstone. And this dark, pristine, amazing sky that we have here tonight is very much a part of that wilderness setting.
Even with those protections, do you feel like the sky is threatened?
Yes. this guy is always threatened because there's, you know, there's no guarantee that protections will always be in place. Things change, right? And as I said earlier, you know, a third of the world cannot see the Milky Way anymore. It's actually estimated that light pollution is going to continue to increase at a rate of about 6% per year. And so by the end of this century, no one in the developed world will have dark night skies unless areas are protected. And so right now, one of the things Yellowstone is doing is trying to qualify or get designated as a dark sky park. In 2015, I think there were 19 dark sky parks around the world, state parks, national parks, and other protected areas. One of the qualifications is that 67%, or about two-thirds, of outdoor lights in your park need to be what we call fully shielded, which means the only light that you see is coming down.
It points down. There's a cover on top of it that prevents it from going up.
Prevents it from going up and also prevents it from going out to the sides. We have more than 5,000 outdoor lights in this park. That's a big job to go and inventory all these lights. So we got some help from Oregon Northern University, and they have inventoried a lot of our lights. They've checked the fixtures, the lamps. They've done some nighttime readings.
As we speak, I'm seeing another example of light pollution, and it's right over that ridge. The Maple Fire is burning, and you can see it coming up over the mountain in the darkness. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, yes. And that's natural light pollution.
We can live with that.
Yeah, we can. And the moon, you know, you only get stars or skies like this when you don't have the moon out, right? And the moon will come up here in a little while.
Well, Tammy Corchero, we've been speaking for all this time in the darkness. I haven't even seen your face.
Yeah, but look at what you have been seeing. I mean, come on.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to be out here with you tonight.
And sure enough, the moon came out a few minutes later and washed away our view. Beauty is fleeting. Look up while you can. That conversation from our trip to Yellowstone back in August.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
And on this Black Friday, caveat emptor. A new Bloomberg report is a reminder to let the buyer beware. And not just when it comes to big ticket items like TVs and couches. Beauty products could be promising more than they deliver. According to that Bloomberg report, many items that claim to contain aloe do not, or they contain it in much smaller doses than their labels say. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us now from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
This is big money. The market for aloe products has grown more than 10% in the last year, but it looks like Bloomberg found that consumers aren't really getting what they pay for.
Right, and this is a timely topic for anyone who could use some soothing aloe after burning their hand on a hot pan yesterday, like I did. But basically, Bloomberg's Lydia Mulvaney and Zeke Fox did a fascinating aloe investigation, if you will. They had tests done of samples of store brand aloe gel. They were purchased at Walmart, Target, and CVS. And the tests actually showed no indication of the aloe plant, even though it was listed as either the number one or number two ingredient after water.
Huh. And instead of aloe, they found something called maltodextrin, which, you know, when I heard that word, I thought that's something you put in food.
Right. That's right. Maltodextrin is a sugar, and it's sometimes used to imitate aloe. It's tremendously cheaper to use as an ingredient. Aloe powder can cost as much as about $240 a kilogram, according to one of the suppliers quoted by Bloomberg. But the cost of maltodextrin is only a few dollars for the same amount.
Is anybody paying attention to this? I mean, I'm just wondering, the Food and Drug Administration, are they weighing in on this? I mean, it feels like these types of products, there should be some sort of oversight, right?
So aloe falls under the category of cosmetics, and the FDA doesn't actually approve cosmetics before they're sold. And the FDA has never levied a fine on anyone for selling fake aloe. So suppliers are sort of on an honor system.
Well, there have been lawsuits against some of the retailers you mentioned. Target declined to comment for your story. Walmart, CVS, and Walgreens, well, they say their products are authentic, which kind of puts you in a bind. I mean, how do you actually know what's true here? Is there any way that the Bloomberg tests could be wrong or bringing up false negatives?
There is a bit of debate as to whether the nuclear magnetic resonance tests are able to conclusively find aloe. The president of a company called Concentrated Aloe Corporation, which makes some of the products in question, said other ingredients can cause interference in the tests, and some ways of processing aloe remove one of the identifying chemicals. But that said, independent of the Bloomberg story, the website ConsumerLab.com tested about a dozen products and found only about half appeared to meet what their labels say. And other experts quoted in the story said the test certainly suggests that aloe isn't a major ingredient at the very least.
This is troubling, I guess. You know, you go to a store, you look at the label, you think you know what you're buying. As you say, this label says aloe's in there. Do consumers just have to have blind faith that that's what they're getting? I mean, what are our options here?
Exactly. And I think as a result of this reporting and some of the lawsuits, we're likely to see some changes, possibly some changes in labels and more efforts to really certify that these products contain what they profess to contain.
Okay. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
It's a big weekend to go to the movies, so let's bring in Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, who's going to help you decide what to see. Ty, hope you had a nice holiday.
Thank you. You as well.
So the biggest film in theaters last weekend, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Tell us about that.
Well, this is a new salvo in the Harry Potter franchise. It's the first screenplay written by author J.K. Rowling, the first time she's actually written a screenplay directly for the screen. And it's got a similar feel. It's set in the 1920s in New York, and the production design is terrific.
A wizardry feel.
It's a wizardry feel. Well, Eddie Redmayne plays a young wizard naturalist named Newt Scamander, who's got a valise full of critters, magical critters that get loose in New York, causing all sorts of cuteness and action.
Well, let's hear a clip about that. Here's Scamander being interrogated by an American wizard played by Colin Farrell.
He was thrown out of Hogwarts for endangering human life.
That was nice, then.
With a beast. Yet one of your teachers argued strongly against your expulsion. Now, what makes Albus Dumbledore so fond of you?
I really couldn't say.
So setting a pack of dangerous creatures loose here was... it was just another accident. Is that right?
What would I do deliberately?
To expose wizard kind. To provoke war between the magical and non-magical worlds.
Okay, Ty, a couple of questions here. Harry, sure. The Harry Potter franchise was so popular. Can this stand up to it? And will Harry Potter fans
like this film?
I think they already do. There's going to be 5 films in this series, so it's not going away.
Yeah.
Harry Potter is nowhere in this film. It takes place years before the events of the books. I think at this point, J.K. Rowling is a brand unto herself, and people know what these movies are going to be, what they're going to deliver. A lot of, you know, digital effects, fantastic stuff, but also a sort of grounding of serious business. And this movie does have its dark side. It's about the political storm clouds embroiling Europe and America in the 1920s. And metaphorically, by association, it touches on things that are going on in our life right now, which is perfectly intentional on Rowling's part.
There's another film that's not getting the acclaim that Fantastic Beasts is, but it has been getting a lot of love. Moonlight, directed and co-written by Barry Jenkins. It is opening slowly in theaters around the country, so it may not be everywhere yet. Tell us about
that. Well, that's a movie that needs careful handling, but it is a beautiful movie. There's a handful of movies this year that are small-scale dramas about real people in America dealing with their life. Manchester by the Sea is one of them. Moonlight is another. They're excellent. This is a coming-of-age story. It's been called a African-American boyhood, which is a disservice to both films, if you ask me. It's about a young black kid told in 3 separate eras of his life, as a child, as a teenager, and as a grown man, played by 3 different actors, coming of age, coming out of the closet, dealing with his sexuality, going back in the closet in Florida in the 80s and 90s. Beautifully written, beautifully acted, goes in none of the expected places, but just seems honest and true and real, and tells a story that about people a lot of us think we know, but we don't, and it's just very much worth seeing.
Now, Janelle Monáe stars in this film. She's a great musician.
She's a terrific musician, but she doesn't sing in this, and it's really a supporting character as the girlfriend of the main character's mentor, who happens to be a drug dealer. And there's a scene here, there's a clip we're going to play, where we hear her. She's really the mother figure for the character in the adolescent section of the film.
What's wrong?
Nothing. You good?
No. I ain't seen good. And you ain't it. And stop putting your head down in my house. You know my rule. It's all love and all pride in this house.
How did Janelle Monáe do in this film?
She's wonderful. I'd love to see her. I mean, when you see her on stage or in her videos,
she's so energetic.
She's just like, you know, coming in from Mars. This is a very realistic role. It's a small role, but it's crucial. She's the warm maternal presence in this kid's life and in the movie that he needs. And she doesn't get a lot of screen time, but she really registers.
Okay, rules don't apply. Warren Beatty is back in our lives.
Yes, he is.
This is a man to whom rules
do not apply.
Yeah.
This is the first movie he has directed since Bullworth and starred in. So that's something of an occasion.
Well, let's hear some of it. Here's Warren Beatty playing the eccentric billionaire Howard Hughes.
These guys want to have a face-to-face meeting with me and then be able to say I'm crazy, and then I'll have to give up control of TWA to them. It's just...
Well, maybe you'd teach him a lesson if you just gave it to him.
Then they could sue me for a whole lot of money, and then they may come after my daddy's company. And so I really can't afford to let him make me some kind of a psychiatric case. I would leave this country and never come back. I'd leave this country and never come back. I'd leave this country and never come back.
A lot of actors have played Howard Hughes over the years. How did Beatty's performance stack up?
This is a deeply eccentric performance in a deeply eccentric film by a movie star who's got his own eccentric side. I mean, this is a project that's been in the works for a long while. Beatty's always wanted to make a Hughes film. And really, he's a major supporting character. The main characters are this young couple in love played by Lily Collins and Alden Ehrenreich. You heard her in the scene. But when Beatty comes on, he kind of takes over the movie, and he obviously is playing Hughes at his most obsessive compulsive. The movie's kind of a mess, but it's a fascinating mess, and it's kind of nice to see Beatty on screen again.
Where's he been all these years?
Raising kids with Annette Bening. She's got a small role in the film. A lot of people show up in this film. Matthew Broderick, Martin Sheen, I could just go on. He like kind of opened up his phone book and said, come on over. I don't think it's a good movie. I think it's a fun movie. And you kind of...
So what does that mean? What do we do with that information? It's not good, but it's fun. Should we go see it?
Yeah, I think you should whenever you want to, whenever in the stream you want to see it, because at this point we kind of owe it to Beatty. He's been around for so long. There aren't that many movie stars of his caliber.
Yeah.
I'll go see whatever he does.
Okay, science fiction. Arrival, starring Amy Adams as a linguist. I've seen the trailers for this film. It looks suspenseful. It looks exciting. What do you think?
This is, this is one of those new mature science fiction movies along the order of Gravity or Martian that are, you know, not really genre-bound but kind of come across as A-pictures. I really liked this movie. The aliens have landed in spaceships that look like the Monolith from 2001 all around the globe. She's a linguist brought in because they're saying something, but we don't even know what their language is. You have a clip that we should listen to where she's in the craft trying to communicate with them, and she's got this big hazmat suit on in the spaceship.
Yeah.
She's got this big hazmat suit on, and they all do. And she says, the only way I'm going to talk to them is if I take it off. So let's listen to this.
Dr. Banks? Hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. They need to see me.
Take it off her hazmat suit. Dr. Banks? Is it okay?
You're risking contamination.
They need to see me.
Dr. Banks?
She's walking towards the screen.
Amy Adams, quite the career she's building.
Yes, yes. She's in a bunch of movies this season, Nocturnal Animals as well. She's one of those people I will watch in anything. I think she just does really interesting work and always takes a character in unexpected directions, as she does here.
Mm. For people who don't mind spending a little time watching a film with subtitles, you've got a recommendation for a French language film, Elle. It's directed by Paul Verhoeven. Many people might remember that name from 1992, Basic Instinct, which is maybe still his most famous film. Tell us about this one.
Oh, Paul Verhoeven is a nasty, nasty boy.
Yeah.
He's been, not just Basic Instinct, but RoboCop, Starship Troopers, Black Book, if you saw that movie a couple of years ago. I almost think of him as like the Vladimir Nabokov of movies in that he plays tricks on audiences. And this is no exception. This is a tough, tough movie with Isabelle Huppert giving one of her best performances. It opens with a brutal rape and assault. And then her character proceeds to refuse to play the victim throughout the rest of the movie to everybody else in her life and certainly to her attacker who comes into her life in other ways that I won't go into. And it gets messy. Let's put it that way. I'm making it sound like a vigilante film. It's not like that at all. Mm. It is as often with Verhoeven, it is a film with a strong and slightly perverse heroine doing things to men that they do not expect.
Huh.
It is tough meat. It is not for everybody. I found it fascinating.
So maybe people will pass on that. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll be pleased by watching that movie. But let's just say if you have one or two options over the weekend, you can't fit all these great movies in, which one do you have to go see?
Fantastic Beasts is a lot of fun. Arrival is a really good big think entertainment. And Manchester by the Sea, which we barely talked about, or Moonlight, either one of those two small movies are infinitely rewarding.
Manchester by the Sea. Quickly, go on that one.
Casey Affleck as a Boston area man with a tragedy in his past, trying to figure out if he can put his life together, written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan, and it is aces all around.
Okay, we got a lot of work to do this weekend. Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Therese Thomas gave birth yesterday on the side of a highway in Yonkers, New York. She told WABC-TV that a 911 dispatcher helped her husband deliver the baby.
They started to walk him through what to do. We're like calling to the dispatcher, I'm over here. Here, the baby's coming.
Wow. Therese Thomas and her husband, Austin, proud parents of a healthy baby girl. Something to be thankful for sure. Now, fasting has become a popular trend. Some of you might be considering it after last night's meal. But does it help you lose weight, and is it safe? Alana Gordon from The Pulse at WHYY looked into the science behind fasting and asked a woman who is a faster to keep an audio diary of her day.
Mimi Dexter L. has not had breakfast in over 2 years.
It is 7:06 in the morning. I am about to get ready for work.
Dexter L. lives in Phoenix and works in marketing.
And right now I am smelling the wonderful aromas of my dear mom making breakfast.
Dexter L. is a big proponent of what's called intermittent fasting. She's even got a blog and Facebook page.
I'm smelling onions, mushrooms, eggs, all this wonderful breakfast food, but I will not be having it.
There are several ways to do intermittent fasting. Some don't eat anything a couple days a week. Others eat every other day. And then some eat during a specific window. For Dexter L., that's between 5 and 10 p.m., which means at lunchtime...
Instead of heating my lunch in the office, I'm heating some tea, white tea, actually.
Dexter L says she had tried a bunch of different diets and exercise approaches.
But, you know, usually would lose the weight, gain it all back, and then some.
Then a couple years ago, she realized things were really getting out of control. She was 44 years old and at 5'5", weighed 237 pounds. She worried about following in the path of her father, who for years did not control his diabetes.
And he has had a few amputations. He's blind. And that definitely scared me straight.
At first, Dexter L says her doctor was wary of the fasting approach, but he saw her weight and bad cholesterol dip.
My numbers just improved in every area. So he eventually kind of came around to it.
So are a number of other doctors and scientists.
Our ancestors before the agricultural revolution undoubtedly had to go extended time periods without food.
This is Dr. Mark Mattson. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins and also heads the neuroscience lab at the National Institute on Aging. He says for most of human history, we needed to be able to fast. Those who couldn't function efficiently on an intermittent diet would die. Mattson is going beyond these evolutionary theories. He's studying the effects of intermittent fasting on the brain and the body.
What defines fasting is a switch in the source of energy in our bodies from glucose that's released from the liver to mobilization of fats from fat cells.
So instead of burning sugar for energy, you start burning fat. Sounds great if you're trying to lose weight, right? But Mattson thinks there are even more potential benefits.
In all our organ systems, essentially the heart, muscle, liver, one thing that happens with fasting is there's reduced inflammation.
And he says reduced inflammation in the body is a good thing. It means healthier cells. And he says those healthier cells in the brain could mean better cognition and possibly protect against diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. He's testing this out right now in a study of older adults. But let's slow down a minute.
It really is not something that I would encourage people to do.
Nutritionists like Stella Volpe at Drexel University is not on board. She worries fasting could be harmful.
It's not sort of teaching them good, healthy eating practices and behaviors to be somewhat consistent in their eating behaviors and their meals and snacks throughout the day.
Plus, Volpe says there haven't been any long-term studies on people. Most of the research is in animals. Still, for fans of intermittent fasting, they say it's working for them.
It is 2:11 p.m. Just got off a conference call a little bit ago.
Mimi Dexter L. would welcome more science to back up what she's doing. But she doesn't see any reason to stop, even when fasting has its moments, like in the middle of the afternoon.
Right now I'm feeling a little tired.
She hasn't eaten anything in 17 hours.
I'm still going to push through.
And before Dexter L knows it, it's time to eat.
It is a little after 5 and I'm home and it's time to break my fast and I haven't decided exactly what I'm going to break it with. I'm looking in the refrigerator. There are many options.
She settles on some papaya. Then she heats up some leftover stew. Later on, she snacks on some popcorn and has a couple pieces of candy. And that's it.
It is 9:20 p.m. and it really wasn't too hard. So we start all over again tomorrow.
For Here and Now, I'm Alana Gordon.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, wishing you a happy and safe holiday weekend. Robin's back on Monday. It's Here and Now.